I thank God for AA. I thank AA and my sponsor for my sobriety. My number one home group is the 6:45 a.m. daily attitude adjustment hour. And we meet every morning, 6:45 for an hour, to get our attitude screwed on straight, and so we can go out there and face the world. We do the third step out loud together, and the seventh step, and the Serenity Prayer, and the Lord's Prayer, and the Vision for You, and the 24-hour book, and when it's best, Bill sees it, and we're the prayingest group you ever did see. And the idea is you get your attitude screwed on straight, and you go out there, and you go from that meeting to the next meeting in such a way that you don't criticize, condemn, or complain about anything, and nobody can screw up your serenity in any way. And by God, someday I'm going to make it. It's a great way to start a day. And if you don't have a morning attitude adjustment hour to go to, well, your program's just not up to snuff, that's all. I go to that meeting every day, except on the days when I don't. Hasn't this been a fantastic weekend? This is indeed the way to run a roundup. That's very impressive. Starting off with, even before the convention started, starting off with Ruth Thursday night and Ray. And what could be better yesterday than a day that with Max in the morning and Dottie in the afternoon and Johnny in the evening? What could you add to that except rain? You know, been a nearly perfect roundup. In fact, it's been such a good roundup, I'm absolutely convinced that it can carry itself for the next hour. And so I'm just going to relax and go with the flow. And I'm just delighted to be here. This is a fantastic thing. You have something special here. It's taken me several days to figure out what it is, but it isn't just your growth, and it isn't... At first I thought it was just your enthusiasm. And that's how it's so many young people. No, that isn't it either. And I've never been any place where I've had as many young people come up and introduce themselves and sit and talk. And it took me a while to figure out what it is. And I think what I notice is you're not divided into us and them. It's just we. You know? You should applaud. Applaud yourself for that. That's very exceptional. I'm delighted to have been exposed to that. Anyway, I guess I'm supposed to talk about being an alcoholic and give you my drunkalogue. It's a fascinating drunkalogue. I tend to get fascinated and forget to get sober before the time is up. Besides, it's kind of, Max has pretty well given you a perverted version of it yesterday. I said I'm an alcoholic, and truth is, I don't even know what an alcoholic is. I just know that I is one. And then you know what to do about it, and that's really all I need to know. Essentially, though, I think of it as that I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I do weird and peculiar things when I drink it. I best not drink it, because I can't drink socially, or sensibly, or safely, or sanely. In fact, I can't drink worth a damn. Just better if I don't drink. And yet, you know, common sense will say, and don't drink it, dummy. Which would be okay. I have a body that doesn't react normally to alcohol. When I have one drink, it tends to... I've never had a drink that didn't satisfy me. I take a drink, I feel satisfied. I feel satisfied all over. But in a little while, that drink says, "Hey, I'm the only one around here who hasn't had a drink." You know? And it wants to drink, and I give that a drink, and then it wants to drink. And I think, well, the easy way to get ahead of that is you have a double. And that, but it can never play catch-up. And so I have a body that when I drink, sometimes, not always, but the longer I drink, the more often it happens, that when I take a drink, it wants another drink and another, and I end up accidentally drunk. That's what I mean when I say I'm an alcoholic. I'm a person who gets accidentally drunk, you know. And so I have a body that can't handle alcohol, which is no big deal about that. Except that I have a brain. Under any circumstances, happy occasion, sad occasion, hot day, cold day, funeral, wedding, whatever, morning, night, alone or with a lot of people, under any circumstance, I say, let's have a drink. So I have a brain that insists on drinking and a body that can't drink. So I both have to drink and I can't drink. I have to drink, but I can't drink. That's a dilemma. What it means is that without AA, you're screwed. You know? I was screwed a long time. Didn't even know what the problem was. I think it was Johnny said it, and some of the others have said it over the weekend. When they take a drink, they feel wonderful. They grow taller, and they're better looking, and they're real clever, and they're wonderful. I don't identify with that. I don't identify with that. I don't recall drinking and feeling all that wonderful. It was more like... I've heard Father Terry say that when he drank, he didn't feel wonderful. When he drank, he felt like he was going to feel wonderful in about 15 minutes. Mine was more that way. I thought, this drink isn't going to do it, but one more really will. You know, the next drink's going to make me feel wonderful. I do recall, though, marked retrospect, I certainly was not aware of it at the time, but thinking way, way back when I was new in practice and building up a practice, they had a lot of church dinner dances. And when you're building up practice, you have to go to church dinner dances. And I don't like church dinner dances because there are people there. And people expect you to talk to them. And they dance, and they expect you to dance. And even if you don't dance, there's always some over-enthusiastic woman comes up and says, "Let's dance," you know. And you say you can't dance. "Oh, sure you can," and drag you out on the floor. I hate women like that. So I would have a few drinks, and you have to have a few drinks if you go to dinner dance anyhow, because I've always had a fear that people would think that I drank too much. And so you have to be very careful not to drink too much. And you have to drink, because my God, if you don't drink, they'll know you have a problem, you know. So you have to drink, and you don't drink too much. So I would have two drinks, just limit myself two drinks while I was there. But I do recall now, again in retrospect, I recall having drinks before I left home. And what that did, it would relax me mentally and physically. And I would relax mentally, and I could talk to people. And I would relax physically, and I could dance. Not real well, but I could dance. Today I don't drink and I don't dance, you know. So I would use that. I would have a few drinks, I relaxed mentally, I could talk, I relaxed physically, I could dance, and it worked very well. But it seems, in looking back on it, that the two got out of sync. And it happened repeatedly. I don't know why it took me so long to see what was happening, but for instance, I would have a few drinks and I hadn't even begun to relax mentally yet, and I would get too relaxed physically. It might show up in my tongue or my mouth or in my voice, and I would find myself talking funny, and I would talk very slowly so nobody would notice. Or I would knock something over when I reached for it. I would trip when there was nothing to... I would find myself lying there on the floor, you know. And my brain would say, get up, you fool. These people will think you're drunk, you know. And my body said, how am I going to get up? I can't even move, you know. And I was often fascinated by the strange effects that alcohol had on my body. Being a scientific bent, I used to think, gee, I react oddly to alcohol, you know. Funny what alcohol does to my body, you know. Didn't help me a bit getting sober, but I was an interesting sign. Other times the reverse would happen. I wouldn't have even begun to relax physically yet. And I'd have a few drinks. And it would be as if all my brain cells got together and says, oh hell, he's drinking anyhow. Let's take the night off, you know? And then I'll go home, and my brain and body go on doing its thing. And in the morning, I would try to figure out what my body had been doing when nobody stayed on duty in my brain to make a record. And I've never figured out how to recall something that wasn't recorded at the time that it was done. Used to worry about that, but I heard Cliff R. from Oceanside talk one time. You should have him come up here and talk to you. He was saying how he used to worry about what he did in blackouts, and finally one day he realized that he never ever had come out of a blackout and found that he had spent the night helping the little sisters of the poor. So I don't pay any attention to my blackouts anymore. My philosophy has always been to know what you want in life. You know, if you don't know what you want, you're likely to not get it. And if you don't know where you're going, you may not get there, you know. And so know what you want. Have your goal. Have a goal. Have it way out there. Have it higher than you can achieve. And then have it, so it'll drive you nuts. And then have intermediate goals along the way so you can get a sense of accomplishment. And then know who you need to get to help you to get there. Know who you need so that they can. That's executive ability. In Al-Anon, they call it manipulation. But I like executive ability better. It's like when I grew up in a drugstore from the age of four. My father, without even asking my opinion, gave up his job as a druggist in Canton, Ohio, and he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio. And I literally grew up in a drugstore. And when I was old enough, they sent me to pharmacy school so I could come home and work in the family drugstore. Actually, the problem with that was that people weren't as impressed with my pharmacy degree as I thought they ought to be. Weren't as impressed as I was. I thought they would be more impressed if I had a medical degree. Problem with that was that my family didn't have any. It was depression. They didn't have money to send me to medical school. They didn't particularly want me to be a doctor. They wanted me to stay home and work to run the family drugstore. And so my solution was to marry the girl next door and suggest she work my way through medical school. Yeah. And that's where Max came in. And the problem with that was that when I got the medical degree, people weren't as impressed with that as I thought they ought to be. I thought they'd be more impressed if I had a specialty. And so I told her, I said, you're doing a good job, kid. Keep on working and we'll get us a specialty degree. And I specialized in internal medicine. And in internal medicine, you study all the diseases of adults. all the non-surgical diseases. You can't stand the sight of blood, so you don't do surgery. But you know a medication for whatever is wrong with people. You diagnose what's wrong with them, you become a specialist, a diagnostician, a specialist in diagnosis, and a specialist then in treatment. You know, you make a diagnosis and you give them something for it. And I knew a pill for every ill. And I was good. She worked in the office with me for 25 years. Drove me to drink for years. And we built up a big practice in internal medicine, and I was very successful. I was very good at it. I'm very ethical. I've never gotten any particular trouble with the law on that. I tried hard, but I never got any trouble. And I even had my own version of the Hippocratic Oath, in that I never gave a patient a pill that I hadn't first tried out on myself. I used to know what you want, work for it, and get people to work with you to get it, and work for control. Working on your problem. I got the AA, and everything tells the preamble, the staffs, the traditions, the book, the Serenity Prayer, the Lord's Prayer, everything says that ain't the way to do it. And that it's working on the problems makes it worse. And the epitome of that, maybe, I was going to say is sleep, and maybe trying to quit drinking. Everything I did to try to quit drinking made it worse. No, it didn't. It made it better, but only for a very short period of time. And then it got worse. What I was going to say before was the epitome of that, of working on a problem, making it worse, is having a problem with insomnia. I was born with congenital insomnia. And I set out to solve that problem. And I started working on it. I used to worry all day about whether or not I was going to sleep at night. And eventually I got to where I worried all night about whether I was going to sleep at night. I did everything. Sleeping pills didn't work until the next day. Tranquilizers hadn't come out yet, and I was back in pharmacy school. I found out I could go to school all day, work in the drugstore all evening, study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, go to bed and try to sleep, and everything I'd been studying would be running through my head, and I'd be half awake and half asleep, and in the morning I'd be both tired and stupid. You know? I found out I could drink a couple of beers, jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And I graduated with honors in pharmacy school and then in medical school, and then I got my specialty boards the first time I took them. And so it worked for me. Don't tell me it didn't work, because it worked. The only trouble is it kept me asleep a shorter and shorter periods of time the longer I used it. And it took more and more to get me to sleep. And I'd have to drink myself back to sleep. And in fact, patients would wake me up in the middle of the night, and I'd have to drink myself back to sleep. The nights were rather miserable. I don't know why hanging up a phone would wake me up, or ring, I shouldn't call it wake me up, bring me out of a blackout. I guess the ringing of the phone would wake me up, and I would have gotten up and walked across the bedroom, because I moved my phone from the head of the bed to the far wall, because I thought I was a heavy sleeper. And I've always had a fear that somehow I'd admit a patient to the hospital in the middle of the night and in the morning forget they were there. I thought I was a heavy sleeper. I forgot I was an insomniac. And I would find I'd gotten out of bed, walked across the room, sat down at the desk, turned on the light, answered the phone, carried on a conversation with somebody, and now was hanging up the phone. And I didn't know who I talked to. I didn't know whether I told them to meet me at the hospital, or I'd be right out and make a house call, or take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning, or what I told them, you know. And you know, when you're a conscientious doctor like I am, you can't go back to sleep with a problem like that. So I would drink vodka and orange juice in case they call back. have to try to get to sleep in case they didn't call back, but I had to be ready to go if they did. So, and everybody knows vodka keeps you breathless. Almost had me practiceless. And I worked on the problem. And it made it, what happened, the more I would drink myself back to sleep, the harder it was to get up in the morning. But I would have no respect at all for a doctor who would drink and go to work. That would be terrible. So I never did that. I'm happy to say I never stooped that low. So what I did is I had a 5 a.m. shut-off time, and I never drank after 5 a.m., which made it hard to get up some days. In fact, I remember the day I thought to myself, my God, man, what would you do for a patient that feels like you do? And the answer came right back, well, I'd give him something to pep him up. And I started taking some appetite appeasers with the upper and the downer in them, and the downer was to keep you from getting too nervous or jittery. And a few days later, I thought to myself, what are you taking a pill with a downer in it for when you're trying to get upper? And so I left the downer out, and I was starting taking straight amphetamines and Ritalin and Benzedrine. And I gradually, that was the same thing. Anything I took, it took more and more to do it, or it had a side effect that made me have to take something else to counteract that. It was always a progressive thing. It's always a progressive thing for me. And so I got to where I was taking 45 milligrams of the long-acting Benzedrine and 45 milligrams of the short-acting just to get out of bed in the morning. And then I would take more during the day to stay up there, and then I would take some tranquilizers to take care of the overshoot. And then the evening came by, and I thought to myself, my God, man, you couldn't sleep before. How are you going to sleep now that you're taking all these pep pills? So I started taking sleeping pills to counteract the pep pills so the scotch could put me to sleep. But I never became a pill head. No, I didn't. So help me, I never became a pill head. Pill heads take pills just to get high or just for the fun of it or just because they like to swallow pills. I never did that. Every pill I ever took, I took because I had the symptom that only that pill would relieve. I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. Every pill was medically indicated at the time and prescribed by a doctor and taken according to directions. And dispensed by a pharmacist. I never became a dope fiend either. The dope fiends use dirty needles and buy their drugs on the street, and they'll take anything. I never used anything but clean needles and pure legal drugs that I had stolen from my patients. I never stole any from a patient that needed it worse than I did. In fact, they usually didn't need it at all. They came in with a flu, and I made a diagnosis of gallstones and called it cholelithiasis. That sounds medical. And I would tell Max was keeping the narcotics record, so I'd make a diagnosis of cholelithiasis and give them 2 cc's of B-complex for the flu, and I'd give me 1 cc of Demerol, and they'd owe me 1 cc. Just love that intravenous Demerol. Oh, you squirt that stuff in the vein, and you stand there and wait, and nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, it lifts you right off the floor, and you just float along. It didn't get that effect from alcohol, but I sure did from Demerol. I never thought of that, but I love that stuff. It's not worth having a slip over, but if any of you ever do slip, you might try some before. Everything I ever took had side effects. Even the pep pills. Thank God. It would make me. What it did is affect my hearing in that I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying sometimes. I hear myself saying something. Well, he's saying that again for you. You've already said it three times. I know. It just sounds so good. I got to say it again, you know. Just love to hear me talk, you know. I do a lot of physical examinations. Being an internist is distinct from a surgeon or whatever. I do a lot of physicals. And when I'm doing a physical on a man, I have him take off everything but his shorts. When I'm doing a physical on a woman, I have them take off everything. And they give them a little plastic thing that has a couple of holes in it, and they stick their arms through it, and it hangs down in front. And they feel like they have something on. And they sit on a table like this, facing this way. And I examine their eyes, ears, nose, throat, neck. And I take a little plastic thing and drop it down. And they sit there topless. And I immediately put my right hand over the left breast, and I say, "Do you examine your breasts regularly for lumps?" It's an interesting thing. It Please. It's an interesting thing that only one of two things ever happens. It's always the same. One of two things happens. They either think to themselves, "My last doctor told me to do that, and I used to do that, but I never found any lumps, so I must not be doing it right, so I stopped doing it, but I ought to be doing it." Or else, they think, "My last doctor told me to do that, but I don't want any lumps in my breast, so I've never done that, but I ought to be doing it." But you see, either way, they're thinking of the scientific aspect of why some man is standing there with his hand on her breast. So, I just never, ever put my hands on a woman's breast without saying, "Do you examine your breast regularly for lumps?" And it's always worked very well for me. But one day, I had a rather difficult night, as I recall, and had the flu that morning, and got to work with the aid of a few extra pills, and felt very much like a martyr going to work, feeling the way I did. And I was examining this gal, and she was very small. It wasn't that she was so short, it was that she just wasn't at all well endowed in the breast department, you know? And I examined her eyes, ears, nose, throat, and neck. I took a plastic thing, I dropped it down, and I put my right hand over left nubbin. And I looked at her very solicitously, and I said, "Do you examine your lumps regularly for breast?" Please, ladies and gentlemen. Need I remind you, this is the Sunday morning spiritual meeting. I've often wondered whatever happened to her. I'm sure she's in AA somewhere. Peggy, I finally found you. Been working on my sleep problem. I even got to where I was injecting Panadol in my veins. You know, Pentothal is what they, an anesthetic they give you. They stick the needle in your vein, they say, count to 10, and you say 1, and zing, you're asleep. Beautiful. It's an instant blackout, that's what it is. And I used to zing myself to sleep with that. I couldn't lie there in bed and have my one daughter call the other daughter and say, hey, come watch Daddy take his nightly fix. And I couldn't drive down to the office and put me to sleep and then drive home and go to bed. So I would keep this stuff in the bag in the car, in the car, in the garage. In the garage, thank God, it was attached to the house. And after a busy day of work and pill-taking and an evening of drinking, I decided it was time to go to bed. I'd go out in the garage and mix up Pentothal, put it in the syringe, stick it in my vein, put the tourniquet on. And I tried to figure out, now, how many pills did I take that I can squirt the stuff in, take it out, take care of it, throw it in the back of the car, slam the car door, run down the hall and jump in bed so I could fall asleep. Yeah. It was very tricky. Took all my pharmaceutical and medical knowledge, because at least a little bit too much, and I just zing right under the car. You know, and or at least a little bit not enough, and I would squirt it in, take it out, take it out, throw it in the back car, slam the car, run down the hall, jump in bed, and nothing would happen. You know, it was all or none. You know, half measures weren't worth a hoot, you know. And worse than that, it didn't last long. It was fast asleep, but fast awake. And one night, you know, this is what working on your problem will get you. One night, I put myself back to sleep that way 4 times in one night. 4 times in one, you know, after a while, you got your foot up on the hood of the car, shooting in varicose veins, and you're getting harder and harder to hit them, and 4 times in one night. And in the morning, I got to thinking about that. And I thought to myself, you know, that's not social sleeping. You know, even to me, it didn't make sense, you know. And yet, you know, I couldn't stop doing that. I couldn't stop shooting that stuff until I found ways of setting barriers, not barriers, threats to my license if I bought anymore. So I made it so I couldn't buy anymore, because if I had it, I used it. And I had to do the same thing with narcotics. I had to set up ways so that I couldn't buy narcotics. That wasn't too hard to do, because I had a building, a medical building beside a hospital. So I'd see people in the office, if they needed narcotics, it was the emergency room right next door and so on. Learning to practice without prescription, without tranquilizer pills and sleeping pills was a little bit more tricky and so on. But I couldn't have drugs around, or alcohol, without using them. If they were there, I had a sleeping problem anyhow, and you can't sleep with those things calling to you. I'm over here, you know. I'm out in the garage. Come on out, you know. I used to work on my sleeping problem. Just that's the limit to what it got. Max and I have had we've been married. Max and I have been married. The end of this year, we'll have been married 44 years. And actually, we've been emotionally involved to varying degrees of intensity for 59 years. Now, to accomplish a deal like that, you know, the first requirement is you've got to be very, very old. We're getting younger all the time. But that was, it started out as a good marriage. It just kind of deteriorated as she went through the various stages of Al-Anonism. And it wasn't that I didn't care, it's that I cared too much. I worked on that problem. Everything I did to help her, it seemed to help for a little while, and then it got worse. And it seemed that the harder I worked on the problem, the worse it got. The more I tried to help that woman, the sicker she got. She just kept getting sicker and sicker. And actually, even when it ended up at the psycho ward, it didn't surprise me. But when that steel door slammed shut, and she was the one that went home, I was amazed. You know? Yeah. Actually, I started out talking about you, how you started meeting out with this, given your sobriety date. Where at home, where I grew up in AA, we start out a meeting with a show of hands. First thing we do is have a show of hands of all the alcoholics. Can we see the hands of the alcoholics there? Isn't that pretty? Yeah. And then we ask for a show, ask for the hand. I know there are Al-Anons here. I can feel the vibration. Can we see the hands of all the Al-Anons? Don't be afraid now. Let's give them a hand. That's enough. That's enough. That's enough. Yeah. Al-Anons are easily spoiled. I'd love to see Al-Anons at meetings. Any kind of meeting. They need all the meetings they can get. They don't laugh. You shouldn't laugh. You should never laugh at the Al-Anon. Our book mentions them. It says they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. I worked on my marriage, and the harder I worked on it, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder it worked on it. Max talked about me taking a course in hypnosis to try to help her, and it turned out she wasn't a very good hypnotic subject, but I didn't give up. I took 6 courses in hypnosis, and I ended up a drunken hypnotist. I worked on my insomnia, it got worse. I worked on my marriage, it got worse. I worked on my drinking problem, and it got worse. I did everything I could to, control my drinking. I used to give up drinking entirely. I'd wake up in the morning and think, my God, I did it again. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous to do that. If you can't drink any better than that, for God's sake, don't drink it. Give it up. Don't drink anymore. I said, that's a good idea. I'm not going to drink anymore. I quit. And geez, it felt good to quit. I got up and go to work, and I think, boy, I'm glad I don't have to drink anymore. I wish I'd have done this a long time ago. Yeah. Go through the day. Good day. Not drink anymore. That's nice. On the way home, I think, we have a social engagement coming up. We walk in this doctor's party, and the doctor's wife's going to say, hi, Paul, what do they have to drink? And I said, I'm not drinking anymore. That's going to be embarrassing for her. You stand out. You make everybody feel inferior by not drinking. So I'll just drink beer. I stop and get a 6-pack, a half quart. In the morning I'd come to and I think, that's ridiculous. You can't drink, you ought not drink. And I'd quit all over again. You know, I did it day after day after day. I quit forever. You know? And I worked on my drinking problem. Everything I did helped for a while, very little while, and then it got worse. I ended up in AA, against my better judgment. It was the only way I could, get out of the nut ward was to have some drunk from AA come and sign a receipt for me and take me out on pass, you know, to an AA meeting. And AA just... Well, it took me 7 months before I became an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic before that. I used to find myself accidentally drunk, but I wasn't an alcoholic. Now that I'm an alcoholic, I don't even drink. And it's funny how dramatically AA has taken away my drinking problem. Now I realize what I just said. Don't come up afterwards and tell me drinking is still my number one problem. I know that. But as long as I do the things I'm doing to keep from drinking, not drinking is the easiest thing I do. It's dramatic the way AA has done that for me. I couldn't do it. I can't stay sober. You can't stay sober, but we can stay sober. My efforts to help you stay sober keep me sober, but my efforts to keep me sober don't work. So it's been dramatic. On the other hand, AA has been dramatic in helping me with my drinking problem. It hasn't been nearly as dramatic, helpful, yes, but dramatic, no. Not nearly as dramatic in helping me with my thinking problem. I have a lot of trouble with my thinking. I don't have a lot of trouble with my thinking. All my trouble is my thinking. Yeah. I've never yet thought I had a problem and been wrong. I've never had a little problem and thought it was a big problem and been wrong. I am total charge of whether my problems are big or little. Any problem I have, all I have to do is to think about it to make it bigger. I'm so good at that I can take an absolute, total, complete non-problem. You can see that it's no problem. It's no problem at all. But if you think about it a minute, it could be a problem. No, just think about it for a minute, because it is kind of a problem. In fact, I soon get the feeling, it's a good thing I'm thinking about this, because it really needs to be thought about, and then I can watch it, and by God, this is a problem, I can't just have a problem without being obsessed with it. Any place I look, that's where it is, And it gets bigger and bigger, and then pretty soon I'm like, look at that goddamn problem, And some fool will say, well, don't think about it. How are you going to think about it? I'm overwhelmed with this problem, and just can't get away from it no matter what I do. It goes to bed with me at night. And finally, the phone will ring. And somebody I'm sponsoring will call up with some really stupid little... Have you ever noticed what chicken shit problems people worry about? A pot behind a stove, or and you know what they ought to do right off. Say the Serenity Prayer, do the third step prayer. Don't think about, you can think of a million answers, but you can't tell them. You can't tell them. You got to wait. If you just tell them right off, they'll think you're insensitive and you don't care. You don't understand. So you have to listen. You have to listen until they feel listened to. When they're through babbling away about their silly little problem, then you pick a number from 1 to 12. I've even heard people refuse to sponsor somebody that asks them to sponsor because they don't think they know how to do it. If you can count to 12, you can do it. Just pick a number from 1 to 12, say, work that step, it doesn't matter which one. Isn't he profound, And they finally get the hang up, and you come running back and say, well, that's my problem, You can't neglect problems. You've got to stay right in there and nurture them, care for them. Problems are very sensitive. You have to, it's a lot of water and fertilizer. Especially a lot of fertilizer. Yeah. Okay. Can't neglect them. My thinking. In fact, I'm sure you have it too. The 20 questions, the Al-Anon spell, you may not know it. The 20 questions about, are you an alcoholic? You get three or more yes, it means you're definitely alcoholic. And I carry them with me because they're a good thing for me to remember. And I like to substitute the word thinking for drinking. Maybe you Al-Anons might want to listen to this too. But I like to go through the questions and substitute that word, and you get real dumb questions. Do you lose time from work due to your thinking? Is thinking making your home life unhappy? Do you think because you are shy with other people? You know? Well, of course, you know. Is your thinking affecting your reputation? You know? Have you ever felt remorse after thinking? You know? Have you gotten into financial difficulty as a result of thinking? You know? Has your ambition decreased since thinking? No, to hell with it. Yeah. Do you crave a think at a definite time daily? This one's a little risky. Do you want to think the next morning? Does thinking cause you to have difficulty in sleeping? Many a time my body wants to go to bed and my brain wants to stay awake and talk about it some more. You know? Even now, often at night, I'll be sleeping and I'll say, wake up, wait, but we want to talk to you. You know? Is your thinking jeopardizing your job or business? Do you think to escape from worries or trouble? Do you think alone? Not all of you can say yes to it, but I can. The one that says, has your physician ever treated you, or have you ever been in a hospital or institution on account of your thinking? But the one I like best is the one that says, have you ever had a complete loss of memory as a result of thinking? Yeah. I shouldn't have gotten up here and said, my name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. I should have said, my name is Paul and we are alcoholic. I'm not alone up here. You know. They make a big deal out of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is split personality. Split it as two. Two. They even wrote a book about, what, Sybil. No. Is that her name? Sybil? Multiple? How many personalities she has? Huh? 13? 16? I hear 16. Do I have any? Huh? Anyway, a whole bunch. Yeah, that's nothing. I've got personalities I haven't even used yet. You know? What I've done, I've had to divide and conquer. I've had to divide me into segments, pieces, personalities. What's happened is I've been run by a committee. And worse than being just a committee, nobody told me I was supposed to be in charge. You know, there's been no chairman. Whoever talked the loudest, that's what we did. You know? It's been like a committee with nobody in charge. And or like a crowded Greyhound bus with no driver. You know? And one of the passengers would get up and drive a while. And then they'd sit down. Somebody else said, drive a while and sit down. We wondered why we never got there. You know, My head has been a condo for rent. The different people move in and stay a while, and they move out. And one of the guys up there is afraid. Afraid of everything. Don't do that. You'll blow it. You'll make a fool of yourself, and they'll all laugh at you. Don't do that. There's one of them that says, "You're going to do it anyway. You're going to do it anyway. You know, doesn't matter what you say. You're going to do it anyway." And we just listen to anybody that happened to be talking. There's one of them there that, no matter what it is, no matter what the situation is, he always has the same answer: "Let's have a drink." There's really nothing wrong with that, except that every time he took a drink, we all got drunk. And I used to turn on my drinker to turn off my thinker. That's the only way I could get to sleep at night, because I wanted to stay there and talk all night about the things during the day that I thought I'd handled very well, and they wanted to explain how I hadn't handled them well at all. I'd really screwed it all up, and in the morning it was going to be just awful. And I used to have to drink to shut them up. And I find I can't do that, because that's... what time did we start, for God's sake? That's how God talks to me. He talks to me. He's one of those voices. So I can't turn them all off. He talks to me one of those voices, and he talks to me as one of the many voices in AA. And I always have to keep listening, because I never know when it's going to be him. And so I can't turn them off. And today I don't want to anymore. I found out a lot of times when they're all talking at once, talk. Sometimes I scream out loud, "Who's in charge here anyway?" And I take charge, and I decide among the many suggestions which ones we're going to follow. And so I'm taking charge of my life in that sense. And that's the way it is with knowing who's listening to God's voice. It's kind of like being at an AA meeting. I let them talk, you know, no matter what they say. They say anything you want. I let them talk. When it's yours, say, "Thank you for participating. Now if you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else," you know, and everybody gets their chance. My thinking's getting, my drinking isn't that much of any problem anymore. I don't know why I'm having trouble with my eye. Thinking is less and less of a problem all the time. My marriage is no problem anymore. Oh, that's a lie. It's, relatively speaking, it's no problem at all. Max and I get along terrifically well. I found that it's much better for me to tell her how I feel about me. How I feel about me rather than what I think about her. Because I am actually, I'm three people in the sense that I am what I do, and you see that, and I am what I think, and I can tell you my opinions and what I think about things, and I am what I feel. And more we deal on the feeling level. I tell her how I feel about me, and she tells me. It's kind of like just being an AA, it's kind of like having an AA podium in the living room, in the bedroom, in the home, and we deal in that relationship, and we kind of treat each other as if we were newcomers. And, well, you taught me how to love, how to, none of this 50-50 marriage stuff. It's 100%. You don't say to a newcomer, 50-50, you know, "I'll pick you up and take you to three meetings if you promise not to drink after that," or if you promise to stand up at a convention and tell them who did that, or whatever. There's no bargaining. You just do it. You don't ask anything of a newcomer. You don't even ask them to quit drinking. You give. You're grateful for the opportunity to give. And Max and I are trying to carry that more into our marriage, and to give instead of what we get. That 50-50 thing was no good. I I used to watch to see whether I gave my only 50, and then I decided my 50 was greater than her 50, and that sort of thing. And I would take some back, and then she'd take some back, and that never worked. So the marriage thing is getting better. The sleep thing is no problem anymore. I've commonly stated at my home group and other places that I've turned my will and my life and my sleep over the care of God. And that way, if I ever die from lack of sleep, we'll know who to blame. And with that threat, he said, I get all the sleep I need. I may not get all I want, but I get all I need. And it's just none of my business whether I sleep or not. My job is to lie down and relax and focus my attention on one thing, whatever that is. And pretty soon my brain gets bored with that and says the hell with it and shuts up and goes to sleep. I decided that if I have the big book by my bedstand and I'm either willing to lie there and rest and either rest or read, I'll either be a good sleeper or an authority on the big book. You know? And either way, it works out all right. So whether or not I sleep is not my problem. And that part's better. And I've decided that we need to... I need to focus more on whether or not I'm enjoying life. Talk about it being the great life and the happy life. My feeling is that if I'm not enjoying my sobriety, if I'm not enjoying my program, I'm not doing it right. I came here to work on problems and try to find solutions that you could work on. And I found out you're not supposed to do that. Everything is let the problem alone and work on yourself. I've heard it said our problems are always in ourselves. We are always the problem. I'm not sure that's always true. I think it's largely true, but I think a lot of times the problem is out there. But we find inside answers to outside problems. No matter where the problem is, whether it's outside or inside, the answer is inside. We find inside answers. Happiness is an inside job. Working on a problem makes it worse. What I need to do is to act as if I had the answer and move on into the answer. That's how I got sober. It took me 7 months of coming to meetings before, as I said, before I could turn into an alcoholic. There are several things that I heard that stand out in my mind that helped me make that switch over to being an alcoholic. One of them was, I remember the guy, a big, husky, healthy guy, stood up there and said, if I don't drink today, I'm a success today. And I said, oh, my God. What a goal in life. You brag about not having a beer today or something. And yet, today I realize that the most important thing I can do today is to not take a drink. And my primary goal in life is to be a successful member of AA. Successful can mean whatever you want it to mean. I vary a little bit, but myself from time to time. But I don't know any successful members who drink or take pills. Or smoke those funny cigarettes. I want to be a successful member of AA. That's my primary goal in life. I also heard somebody say of themselves, they stood at the podium, they said, I was judging me by my intentions, and the world was judging me by my actions. And God, that was painful to hear him say that, because I've always been a man of tremendous good intentions. I've always wanted to be a better doctor, a better husband, a better father, a better man, better everything. I've always had tremendous, always been in a let's be a better person business. And when that person said that, I just stripped myself of my intentions and looked just at my actions. And I turned out to be a drunken doctor, a drunken husband, a drunken father, a drunken citizen, a drunken neighbor, just a common, ordinary drunk. And it was painful, but it was very meaningful to me. And one of the things that really clinched it was the time that somebody said, look, I spent all this time trying to figure out, is I really or is I ain't? And finally somebody said, of himself, they said, I would rather be in AA by mistake than out there by mistake. And I made it 2 columns, what it costs to go on drinking. We complain about the high cost of inflation, but the high cost of drinking is just tremendous, an instant death. What does it cost to be in AA? You gave up a weekend to come here. Isn't it painful? So it just seemed to me like the logical thing to do. And at that moment, I switched from living in the problem to living in the answer. I accepted the fact that I did have a drinking problem. Probably was even a serious problem. In fact, I might even be a kind of alcoholic. Some mild kind, you know. And I bet there are people out here today that don't think they're really, 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 really alcoholic. I just want to say to you, you don't really have to be all that bad. You know, you can, in fact, you can even lie a little bit. You know, I did, and. I've never seen anybody asked to leave AA because they weren't alcoholic enough. I've seen a lot of people leave because they didn't think they were alcoholic enough. Never seen one of them come back, if they got back, who didn't come back more alcoholic than they left, you know. So there's 2 ways to become more alcoholic. You can either drink some more, which is a painful way, and you might never get another crack at sobriety, or you can stay. And as you say, you'll become more alcoholic even as I did, because everything I'm telling you tonight, I didn't know when I came here. Didn't remember. And you don't have to be all that bad to belong here. I hesitate to say this publicly, but it's actually, we're generally well known for the fact that in this organization we'll take just about anybody, you know. Acceptance was the key to sobriety for me, and acceptance is the key to serenity for me. Accepting life on life's terms, accepting life as it is rather than as I wish it were. And my thing through life always has been, it's okay to be upset as long as you knew what you're upset about, and it was a good reason. And my favorite story was to talk about what Max had done. Let me tell you what you did now, sort of thing. Always explaining it based on what you've done now. I remember not too long ago, I called my sponsor, and I was telling him something that Max had done again. And I guess he had heard this often enough that he was getting a little tired of it. And his favorite expression is, well, whatever. If you haven't got a sponsor yet, don't pick one who says, well, whatever. You know, I was telling him about Max, and he says something, he stopped me, and he says, well, why don't you just put it out of your mind for a couple of days? And I said, what do you mean, put it out of my mind for a couple of days? In 2 days, I'll forget about it. You know, what I've had to do with the, one of the most difficult things I did, I've always had the feeling I would be a different husband if Max were a different wife. And one of the gals at my morning meeting said that her sponsor had told her that her job wasn't to make her husband a better husband. Her job was to make herself a better wife. And I tried to accept the challenge of being the husband I would be if Max were the perfect spouse. Don't try that if you're not ready for it. You know, it's a hard one to carry off, I'll tell you. So anyway, my relationship with Max is better. My relationship with God is far better. A lot of people have had to change spouses. I didn't. I've changed God concepts. I have a different relationship with God. We get along fine today. We're good friends. We ride to work together every morning, except on the days when he forgets. And I no longer tell him things to do because... I tell him, I'll pedal and you steer. And for God's sake, watch where you're going. Sick of some of the places we've been, you know. And He's got a lot more time now because I don't tell him things to do and things to keep from happening. And as a result of that, you might be interested in this, as a result for that, I rent him out. God, I rent him out free. So if any of you don't have a God that you can rely on and use and believe in or anything else, use my God. Just go ahead and use him. I'm just telling him I sent you. And see how it works. If you don't have to believe in them, just believe that I believe and use them. And actually what that is like is this is as if I told you I gave you a book of blank checks and said there was $1 million in an account. Go ahead and write checks. Now you could be too smart. You could just know that wasn't true. And be so smart that you wouldn't write any checks. And you'd be right. Because for you, there wouldn't be any money. But if you wrote a check and they cashed it, and you wrote another check and they cashed it, the more checks you wrote and they cashed, the more you'd be likely to write. And for you, it would be true. And that's the only way you'll ever find out whether God is there or not. You're going to have to write checks. And if they cash them, fine. You know, what... Even if he's not there, you got the money, you know. So that's the way God works for me. He and I are good friends, and you're free to use them anytime you want. My God is not so hooked on this heaven and hell business. I've been told all my life that I'm going to go to hell. I've been told all my life. Priests, ministers, nuns, clergymen have been telling me all the time. If I don't do what they tell me to do, God's going to send me to hell. Or heaven or hell, one or the other, but it's most likely hell. But when we die, we're going to go to the pearly gates. And before we get in, we have a pre-admission interview with God. And he's going to say, "Were you good?" And based on that, he's going to send you to eternal reward or eternal damnation. I've never met anybody who's had their interview. I've never met anybody who met anybody who's had their interview. So it must be true. They wouldn't tell us if it weren't true. But I'm still not absolutely sure. And that might be just a theory. And as such, I'm allowed to have my own theory. And I think God has just gone to a hell of a lot of trouble. Excuse me, God. God has gone to a lot of trouble to make us happy. He's done all kinds of things to me. Why so many joyous occasions? Why so many occasions for joy? Why so many varieties of beauty? Why so many opportunities for love? I think he really is much more concerned with whether we're enjoying it, whether we're happy or not, and just exactly what we've done every minute in our bedroom, and whether we had a dirty thought or not. I think he really wants us happy. And it's my feeling, at least it is with my God, that when we get there, if we get to a pearly gate, and if there is a pre-admission interview, he's not going to say, "Were you good?" According to the current theory, he's got a book full of marks that proves that anyway. He doesn't need to ask you. What he's going to say is, "I've been working hard. I've been staying up day and night, giving you everything you need to be happy. I may not have given you everything you want, but I've given you everything you need to be happy. Now tell me the truth. Did you enjoy it down there?" And if you say, "Well, gee, God, if you'd have told me..." He'd probably say, "No, well, quit stalling. Just tell me the truth. Were you happy? Did you enjoy it?" And if you say, "Well, not really, God," he'd probably say, "Well, you can go to hell." Thank you very much.